Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and we are back at the National Theatre in London for another show of Private Eye live at the National. We're here for the Private Eye Annual, which is being dramatised tonight, very excitingly, by a cast including Lewis McLeod, Harry Enfield, John Sessions and Jan Ravens, with extra guitar solos from Craig Brown. And here to kick it off is the magazine's editor, Ian Hislop.
Thank you. And to start, we're going to have a piece to cheer us up, reproduced from Private Eye's sister paper, The Penguin Times. It gives you the news in black and white. This opinion piece from The Penguin Times was written by a distinguished 93-year-old penguin, and it's called Should We Step In and Help Humans?
We've all seen the footage. The desperate plight of millions of powerless Brits trapped deep in a harsh, unforgiving hole, facing certain doom with no idea how to get out. Should we, as penguins, let nature take its course and leave them to their fate? Is it our duty as intellectually and moral superior creatures to waddle in and help them escape in some way? Or should we let them jump over a cliff? In slow motion with stirring music and a commentary by myself. At the moment, their future looks cold and bleak. Should we save them from Brexit? Sadly, the answer has to be no. It's none of our business. We're penguins. We've got to let nature take its course.
Thank you to Penguin News. Private Eye, of course, is known for better commentary than that, and mostly it's about the city and politics, and that area where the city and the politics clash with conflicts of interest. And we publish statements from various companies, and this is a financial statement from none other than the well-known financier and politician, Jacob Rees-Mogg, MP.
As a distinguished senior partner in the Somerset Capital Asset Management Scheme, known as SCAM for short, I would advise investors in our £2 billion fund that despite my total confidence in the successful outcome of Britain's exit from the European Union, we have decided to relocate a part of our operation to the Irish Republic. Even though I am personally sure that Brexit will undoubtedly bring Britain a period of unprecedented prosperity, we deem it prudent to hedge our bets by establishing a small office for SCAM above Mr. Seamus O'Flaherty's widely respected bar off Molly Bloom Street in Dublin. In the very unlikely event of the British economy totally collapsing as a result of the very sensible approach to Brexit so eloquently advocated by myself, it might turn out to be crucial to the survival of SCAM that we retain a foothold somewhere within the territories of the European Union. I believe this decision will further reinforce the attraction of our international portfolio, which includes our much-acclaimed investment vehicle, Putin SCAM, which enables us to profit from the fast-expanding market in companies run by very wealthy friends of the Russian president. In conclusion, I have total confidence in Britain's ability to create a modern, go-ahead, optimistic future, forging new trading relationships with countries such as Mesopotamia, Persia, and Cathay.
Jacob is, of course, still alive, but we tend to cover the recently dead by means of our poet. He is a eulogist, a threnodist, E.J. Thribb. He writes obituary verse when someone has died. This is In Memoriam Ken Dodd, entertainer.
So, farewell then, Ken Dodd. They say you used to go on forever, but sadly, that wasn't true. They also said only two things in life are certain, death and taxes. Unfortunately, you only avoided one. And now it's naughty ashes to ashes.
We even run a TripAdvisor service in Private Eye, and this is the TripAdvisor. It's a review of the cathedral city of Salisbury. By Russian tourists Alexander and Ruslan.
As ordinary citizens with no connection whatsoever to the Secret Service, we had a lovely time in this quaint English rural town.
We went to a number of places of interest, including the famous cathedral and Mr. Skripal's front door.
We were so exhausted after 1 hour's sightseeing that we headed back to our lovely hotel in Bow, East London.
The snowy weather was also very difficult for us Russians because we so rarely see snow in Russia. But we loved Salisbury so much that we went back the next day and had a lot of fun trying to avoid all the CCTV cameras.
We saw all the sights, but found we still had a bit of time to kill.
We had a great time, and definitely won't be going there again, or indeed anywhere outside Russia.
Unfortunately, we lost our duty-free perfume somewhere in the area. If found, please don't return.
Thank you to TripAdvisor. Now time to change things around a bit and introduce Private Eye's great parodist, Craig Brown, who writes a diary for us in the back in every issue. There's quite a lot of them in the annual, which I hope you'll enjoy. Ladies and gentlemen, can you welcome Craig Brown onto the stage? And Craig's first diary, he is channeling Kenneth Rose, the very well-known Sunday Telegraph diarist. Now, his diaries have just been published. He was a great fan of the royal family. He chronicled high society. His critics said he was a social climbing snob. But no, Craig is here to prove otherwise.
8th of October, 1970. Over dinner at Pratt's, Bobberty Bristol tells the most amusing story. Bubbles Birmingham and I are all ears. Apparently, Hector Chumley once asked Walter Pettigrew to luncheon at Boodle's, little realising that Pettigrew much preferred Pratt's, having once been served there with a plate of slightly lukewarm tomato soup. He is, of course, well known for liking his soup piping hot. 10th of October, 1970. I had just finished telling Tommy Lassells the story of Pettigrew and Chumley at Boodle's when Tommy pipes up that Pettigrew's dislike of lukewarm soup is greatly exaggerated. Say what you like, but I once saw Pettigrew spoon an entire plate of gazpacho into his mouth without so much as a backward glance, he says, a trifle vehemently. Yet people still go on and on and on about Pettigrew disliking his soup lukewarm. Needless to say, I hesitate to point out that gazpacho is generally served cold rather than lukewarm. Towards the end of our meal, Tommy tells me a most amusing story involving the Earl of Crookenden and a shaving brush. 11th of October, 1970. Dine at the beefsteak. Sit between Sir Percy Nutter and Lord Curtsy Cutesy of that ilk. They find it hard to conceal their amusement when I tell them, strictly entre nous, that Tommy Lassells is labouring under the misapprehension that gazpacho is served lukewarm. 12th of October, 1970. to the Travellers Club. General Sir William Alday Carvery can't wait. Can't wait to tell me that Tommy Lassells thinks that gazpacho is a soup served hot. I hesitate to tell him the true story, i.e. that Tommy believes gazpacho is served lukewarm. It shows how often these stories get exaggerated. As an historian, one must always be on the lookout for these anomalies. 17th of July, 1980. Luncheon at Clarence House. Her Majesty the Queen Mother has never been more brilliant. What is the secret of this extraordinary woman? She's always beautifully dressed and in the highest of spirits, and she's able to lay on magnificent repasts for 12 or more guests with astonishing regularity, and all with a staff of barely 65. She is a woman of supreme intelligence. Did I ever tell you of my encounter with Pettigrew and the gazpacho, I say? Yes, you did, Kenneth, she replies. She has the most remarkable recall for people and places. At one juncture, I happened to mention the East End of London. With no prompting whatsoever, she informs us that it is a few miles in that direction, pointing to Trafalgar Square and beyond. It's the most extraordinary feat of memory. I don't know how you do it, ma'am, I say. She says she's full of admiration for the warm-hearted men and women of East Cockney. You know, they simply adore one. In return, I make a point of visiting them every 40 years or so. I would go more often, but one doesn't want to overdo it, does one? Or they get so spoilt. An object lesson in generosity and selflessness. I make a note in my diary to tell Bobbity and Bubbles over breakfast at Boodle's.
Craig Brown! We go from the very English to the very American, and of course, it's Trump. We couldn't avoid him for any longer, as so many people say in litigation. This is Trump's performance when the powerful tropical storm Hurricane Florence swept across the eastern seaboard, leaving a trail of devastation and destruction in its wake. The president took personal control and tweeted from his bedroom at 3 a.m.
I have never met Hurricane Florence. I never slept with her. Unless she's that friend of Stormy Daniels.
Mr. Trump took some time to consider his position and at 3:01 qualified his earlier tweet.
Oh, hang on, it's all coming back to me. Hurricane Florence signed a non-disclosure agreement and has nothing further to say on the matter. I got my lawyer to deal with it all, but I did not pay her money.
At 3:02, he continued.
Okay, I did pay her money, but it wasn't from campaign funds. It was from my own personal bank account.
3:03.
All right, it was from campaign funds. But in no way was it a huge donation from the Russians. Call off this witch hunt now.
3:05.
Okay, it may have been Russian money, but I didn't know about it, which makes it fake news. Hashtag failing New York Times.
At 3:06, the president exploded back onto Twitter.
Hey, why have the cartoons been taken off to show me some boring windstorm? Who cares? Come on. Hashtag failing Cartoon Network.
3:10.
Looney Tunes, deeply disturbing. Speedy Gonzalez, so-called fastest mouse in Mexico. I demand extradition of Gonzalez of charges on rape, murder, and drug peddling. Lock him up, build that wall. That's enough. Get him out of here. Great job.
Lewis McLeod. We do have our own scandals in Britain, and obviously in the interests of balance, we move straight on to Boris. A terrific year for Boris. We learnt who the mystery blonde was that he was in love with. It's himself. And we learnt that he sent two letters to his wife when the news of his infidelity came out, one arguing he should remain, one that he should leave. He did, in fact, leave. Now, This is about the press, and this is about the Daily Telegraph, which changed its name earlier this year to the Daily Borisgraph. It runs a piece by Boris every Monday, which it then puts on the front page. This is one of many of his columns under the headline, "Brexit will be car crash," says Brexiteer who was driving car.
With her foot full on the throttle, Prime Minister Theresa May's backing into a corner. Wah! Where she's going to hit the buffers without leaving time to jump into the lifeboats and sail over the cliff. Wah! Not since 1066 has this country faced a pileup of metaphors as serious as that created. Wah! By the so-called Chequers Plan, a proposal so calamitous that I voted for it before David Davis resigned. And I thought I'd better resign as well in case I missed the boat. Wah! Where was I? Oh, yes. Wah! 1066. Magna Carta. Have we forgotten? Wah! Wah! Have we forgotten that momentous moment in our island story when the Duke of Wellington confronted William the Conqueror and said, "No"? Or, to use a sporting metaphor for the man on the Clapham Omnishambles, we are 5-0 down in extra time. Wah! With the ball turning on a sticky wicket and the referee asking for a third umpire as we go into the championship tie break. Oh, what can we do? Simply adopt my 6-point plan for clearing up the mess that I didn't anyway create. 1, reject Mrs. May's terrible plan. 4, 2, come up with a brilliant plan of my own, which will work really well. 3, adopt the Super Canada Brexilistic Expiala Plus Plus. 4, even though the sound of it is simply quite atrocious. 5, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. 6, Super Canada Brexilistic Expiala Plus Plus. Gotta go, I think my pants are on fire. Whoa.
Boris Johnson. We also cover sport in Private Eye, particularly in our column Commentator Balls, which are all sent in by readers, and they are real examples of commentators trying to fill in time whilst they're watching sport. These are all genuine. We start, of course, with football. Paul Merson on Sky Sports.
He's moving a bit sheeplessly at the moment.
Perry Groves on TalkSport 2.
They had a couple of little soirees into the opposition box.
Sports presenter, BBC Radio Lancashire.
We can have this debate till we're blue in the teeth.
Ian Dark, BT Sport.
With Everton 2-0 down, Sam Allardyce will throw caution to the window.
Andy Hinchcliffe, Sky Sports.
The lone striker role was always going to be a two-man job.
Jermaine Jenas, BBC One.
I wouldn't say it was a confidence issue, but he just started to lack a belief in himself.
Sports presenter, BBC News.
Argentinian fans chanting from dusk till dawn and probably overnight as well.
Stephen Warnock, Radio 5.
Liverpool's early goal has given them fresh impotence.
It's not just football, though. Cricket's just as bad. Conor McNamara on Radio 5 Live.
Vaughan saw a chance there to put his name in the headlamps.
Sports reporter, Radio 5 Live.
Do you think there'll be a tear in his eye when the finger goes up?
Stuart Broad, Sky Sports.
Cricket is a game without boundaries.
Ed Smith, Radio 4.
Roots retired ill again with gastroenteritis. Problems at both ends for England now.
And the last word to Claire Balding, who's presented nearly all sports this year. This was her view on the Winter Olympics.
It was, I think, wonderful from beginning to start.
Ladies and gentlemen, the commentators. Just time to find out what's happened to another of our great leaders, Tony Blair. a diary.
Thursday. The truth is, these days, I'm more in demand than ever. I'm quite literally rushed off my feet. I grab breakfast at home and quickly scan Twitter for reaction to my major keynote speech on the need for global interdependence. Brilliant. It's been retweeted by independent assessors at the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. And BBC Wales Today have also retweeted it, which is great. I put an urgent call through to my old buddy, President Barack Obama. Yo, Barack, Tony here. How's it going? Just keen to touch base over global interdependence. The response was immediate.
This is the office of President Barack Obama. Please leave your name and the purpose of your call, and we will get back to you as soon as possible.
Friday. Find I have a few hours between a solo working breakfast and perhaps grabbing a bite to eat that evening. So I go out to have a chat with my police protection guys. I like to exchange friendly banter with them. Looks like it's going to be a nice sunny day, I said this morning. That means it's time to get our umbrellas out, said one to the other. I guess they must have misheard me. Barack has not called back. I hope I didn't miss his call while I was watching Countdown.
Tony Blair. I know we're running out of time. We have to end with Sir Herbert Gusset. Sir Herbert Gusset is still writing letters to the Daily Telegraph from deepest Somerset, and this letter was the subject of a film about Winston Churchill, which I hope you all saw. Ladies and gentlemen, Sir Herbert Gusset.
Sir, as lifelong admirers of the late Sir Winston Churchill, undoubtedly the greatest British Prime Minister of this or any other age. My wife and I recently drove into Market Barkworth to attend a cinematic performance of the new film Darkest Hour. Imagine our horror on discovering that this supposed account of the momentous events of 1940, which Lady Letitia and I remember as if it was yesterday, was nothing but a complete travesty of the historical facts. Not 5 minutes into this film, we were shown footage of what purported to be a typical London street of the time, in which one could clearly see, driving along in the background, a 1953 Ford Consul. At least the film was redeemed by the one inspiring scene where Churchill is shown as having doubts as to whether Britain should continue to fight the Nazis or sue for peace. Churchill enters the carriage of an underground train where he seeks the views of a typical cross-section of ordinary 1940 Britons. A chimney sweep called Bert, a children's nanny who gives her name as Miss Poppins, a cloth-capped dustman, Mr. Doolittle, and his charming daughter, Eliza, who works as a flower girl, plus several representatives of Britain's then worldwide empire, including a turbaned Sikh, a stern-looking imam, and a West Indian expert on British and Roman history, all of whom are shown conducting an animated discussion on Britain's military options with gallant members of London's wartime LGBTQ community. Quite rightly, they all end up shouting, "Go for it, Winnie. Kick that Hitler in the ghoulies. The nation is right behind you." As they all produce Union Jacks from their pockets to sing a rousing chorus of Rule Britannia, the Prime Minister bursts into tears and then strides off to the House of Commons to deliver the speech which undoubtedly won. The war!
Herbert Gossett! Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all very much for your patience. Could I ask you, therefore, in this particular order, to show your appreciation for Jan Ravens, Mr. Lewis MacLeod, Mr. Craig Brown, Mr. Harry Enfield, and Mr. John Sessions. Thank you all very much from Private Eye, and thank you for sticking with us again. Good night.
So there you have it. There are the edited highlights of this year's Private Eye Annual. Those and all the lowlights are also available in annual form, online, and in all good bookshops. We will be back again in a fortnight's time with another episode from The Office. Until then, thank you for listening to this. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.